Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
Welcome back to How I Learned to Love Shrimp. We're back with a very special episode with Andres from the Shrimp Welfare Project, which is the only organization in the world solely dedicated to improving the lives of shrimp. Even more impressive than that, they were the inspiration for our podcast name, so this is a very exciting podcast for us. In this episode, we talk about the case for working on shrimp, the current scale of and practices within shrimp farming, as well as what Shrimp Welfare Project have learned over the past 2 years of doing this work. Hey everyone, we are joined today by Andres Jimenez Orilla, who is the CEO and one of the co-founders of the Shrimp Welfare Project, one of the very few organizations focused on reducing the suffering of farmed shrimps worldwide. Welcome, Andres.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, we're very excited to have you. As one of the originators for our name, I think it was only fair that you came on the podcast pretty soon. And let's dive straight into it. So one opening question that we've kind of changed and we like to ask people now is, what's an animal-related view you've changed your mind on recently and why have you done that?
The first one is the importance of invertebrates. I have been a vegan for maybe 15 years. And until maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had never really given invertebrates much thought or consideration. And it was really until I read the report that Charity Entrepreneurship had prepared for this idea of someone focusing on shrimp welfare that I realized, oh my God, this is something extremely important that someone should be focusing on.
Was there a particular moment in that report that stood out for you? Like, was it a fact or something about the welfare or neglectedness of that area?
It was like page 2. It was when they showed the numbers.
Fair enough.
I think my initial reaction when I read that someone should be focusing on shrimp welfare was these people in the animal movement. Like, we've just gone crazy. And then I turned the first page and I realized, oh my God, I cannot do anything other than this.
Yeah, well, for context, I was in the same charity entrepreneurship cohort as Andres. And when I also saw the Shrimp Welfare Project, I was also like, wow, people have gone too far. And then you're right. As the more you learn about it, the more you're like, wow, this is actually quite important. But I think you were more courageous, let's say, than I was. And you're doing it, which is very, very amazing.
Thank you.
Did you have anything else you changed your mind on?
Yes. Well, I think when my co-founder and I, Aaron, when we started Shrimp Welfare Project, we had a very rough idea of what we wanted to focus on, and slaughter was not really within our top priorities, and it was until we saw a harvest, which is what people call when the shrimps are taken out of a pond, and saw that whole process, that we realized that was something that was, you know, absolutely needed to be changed and improved. So we incorporated that, and now it's an important part of our strategy, as I'm sure we'll talk. Well, I hope we'll talk about further on.
Yeah, for sure. As James said, feels like kind of poignant moment to be interviewing CEO of Shrimp Welfare Project for our 10th episode. It felt we would be neglecting the podcast if we didn't chat about the first organization really working on this issue and dedicating your time to doing that. But I'm interested in your journey to animal advocacy and particularly this type of work. You didn't always work, as many of us, in animal advocacy. Can you talk us through your entry into this type of work?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a long-winded way into the animal movement. But my wife has been a long-time vegan, and she convinced me one day to read a book titled Skinny Bitch,
interesting.
So I was like, okay, I'm gonna read this. I thought it was the only book at home that I hadn't read, and I thought it was something related to health, and eventually I got to a point where they describe some really graphic scenes of animals being, well, slaughtered for food. And that's when I became vegan. But this didn't got me into switching jobs, at least not for a while. There was always this cognitive dissonance. I was working in investment banking and in private equity for another 10 years after that. But I always felt that I wasn't doing what I felt was most important. And in 2018, I quit that job. It was just the cognitive dissonance got to a point that was too much to bear. I took some time off to figure out how I could help animals. And I really considered quite a few things, including starting a farmed animal sanctuary. But then thankfully, I realized that I had no idea on how to care for animals and that I should try and help them in some other way. And again, my wife introduced me to effective altruism and charity entrepreneurship. And I went down the rabbit hole, read the Shrimp Offer Project report. And that's how I ended up working in to help animals, shrimps specifically.
So we have a lot to thank your wife for, right?
Sounds like a lot.
Really do. Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, and did you read the report and then choose to go on the program, or did you go on the program and then see the report? Because if anything, that report would have almost put me off.
I did read the report, and I found it to be really interesting. I disagreed with a few things, but overall I thought it was quite interesting. It had the, as you well might recall, there were some other ideas when we did the charity entrepreneurship program that also seemed attractive to me, like improving the feed of hens to avoid keel bone fracture. And then there were a few other that were non-animal related that I also thought were very worthwhile things to work on. So I thought, you know, I'll do the program, and whatever I end up choosing, if they do choose me, I'll be doing something worthwhile, certainly much more so than I felt that I was doing back then.
Very cool. To just go from, I guess, page one, do you want to give us the basic case or the best case for working on shrimp and why it's an important way to help animals?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very good question. And I would say, in a nutshell, the numbers of animals, shrimps in particular, that are killed for food every year are astronomical. The evidence of their sentience is significant, and there are no more than a dozen people working to improve their lives. So it's highly neglected. And I think, as we have now found in the last almost 24 months that we've been in existence, there were significant improvements to be made that were very tractable. So yeah, that would be a very simplistic way to put it.
The holy trinity of scale, neglect, and distractibility. I think we'll look like. might know that one. Very cool. And in terms of actual scale, do you want to give us a size of the numbers in terms of both maybe how many are affected and like maybe how bad their lives can be as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as you know, in aquatic animals, or as you may know, the animals are typically not counted as individuals as you would in land farmed animals. Here, the number of shrimps produced are measured in tonnage, so we can only have estimates of how many shrimps we're talking about. But with some simple kind of volume or tonnage divided by average weights, etc., you get to around half a trillion with a T, shrimps being farmed each year. And that's only farmed. If you go to wild caught, so shrimps that are caught in the open ocean, we've seen estimates from think tank Rethink Priorities that puts it in the tens of trillions. So the numbers are really, this is probably what was on page two of the report. I thought, someone needs to work on this.
By those numbers, that would make it the most farmed animal in the world. Is that right? And the most caught in the wild? Do you know?
I would think that the most caught in the wild, yes. The most farmed, I'm guessing by now,
insects
will probably be, insects will probably be a greater number.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's a close second. Yeah. And just to give it some perspective versus land farmed animals, when you put it in comparison to chickens, for example, this is about 7 times the total number of chickens that are slaughtered every year. And if we put the total number of land farmed animals, which as your listeners will probably know, chickens are most of them, it's still 6 times the total number of land farmed animals. So chickens, pigs, cows, goats, all of that put together, we farm and slaughter 6 times that many shrimps every year. So it's
incomprehensible. Yeah, just completely. I don't know how you even begin to envisage that kind of number. It's just beyond our like capabilities, right? To imagine such a trillion of something it's unreal.
Totally agree, and it's mind-boggling when you stand in front of a pond and people tell you, oh yeah, we have, you know, these many tons of shrimps in the pond, and you do the quick calculation and you come out at, you know, millions of animals in this little body of water, frequently not very large, in front of you, and it just blows your mind.
Yeah
I mean, I just did a very quick sum, and it's like 15,000 shrimps per second for the farmed animal one, which is like, still doesn't, even when it gets much smaller, you can't quite understand how this could be happening at such a high rate. Yeah, maybe then in terms of what Shrimp Welfare Project is doing about this, so maybe just a high level view of what do you do, what's your theory of change. I'd love to hear more.
The way that I would describe it is we work with the demand side doing relatively traditional corporate outreach work, corporate engagement work. We don't do campaigns. It's really a friendly approach to corporates. Typically, we would then try to get those corporates, for example, retailers somewhere in Europe, to connect us with their producers, so the people that they are sourcing their shrimps from, so that we are then working also with the supply. We work directly with producers, sometimes large, sometimes tiny producers. So that would be kind of our demand and supply side work. And then we also work on increasing issue salience, and that would have 2 parts to it. One is just raising this, the issue of shrimp welfare as a relevant topic to be discussed in the relevant forums, and also to increase the level of knowledge out there as it relates to the welfare of the animals, because unfortunately we're dealing with a species where we have very, very limited welfare focused research that we need to base our decisions on. So we work with the demand side, we work with the supply side. We try to increase the body of evidence of what constitutes high welfare, and we try to promote practices that lead to high welfare with all of the stakeholders, so that then that leads to changes in practices at the farm level, because that's ultimately where welfare is, you know, observed or neglected. And that eventually leads to greater welfare or reduced suffering. That would be our theory of change.
Great. Within, I guess I've got a couple of questions then. So within the corporate outreach side, so you're saying you don't do campaigns, but is there an ask that is there like a commitment you're getting them to uphold or commit to? Or is it just introducing them to the supply side, introducing you to their supply side?
At the moment, it's very ad hoc. We do have an ask that includes observing, sourcing shrimps from producers that observe certain minimum water quality parameters. So shrimps live in the water, so they need to be in water that has certain levels of oxygen, not have, you know, poisonous gases in there, things like that. So we do ask them to source from producers that typically would observe these minimum water quality parameters, that they do not perform certain practices that can be avoided, which I'm sure we'll get into shortly, like iStock ablation, and more and more to also render the shrimps unconscious at the moment of slaughter, which very few producers at the moment do anywhere in the world, really. Those are big asks to retailers, who then frequently we've realized that they do want that. They want to see that in their supply chain. They just haven't found a way to facilitate that change in their suppliers, because they're sufficiently removed from the production of shrimps that they frequently don't even know how shrimps are produced. Well, not frequently, sometimes. And that's where we come in, by saying, okay, we not only have this ask that we wanted to do, but we also have very concrete ways in which we can support your supply chain to improve these practices.
Yeah.
So we kind of try to tie those two things together.
Yeah. And is it mostly imported, particularly when you're working with retailers like in Europe, for example? Where's the shrimp actually coming from?
It's almost exclusively imported. 90%+ of shrimps, farm shrimps, are produced in Asia, from China to all the way down to Southeast Asia, all the way to kind of Bangladesh. And then Latin America as well, from sort of Central America down to Ecuador. And that's 90%+ of the volume, maybe 95% of the total global volume. There is a nascent industry of indoor shrimp farming. So little tanks that are put inland. But that still represents a tiny fraction of the global volume. So in Europe, farmed shrimps consumed in Europe are almost exclusively imported either from Ecuador or Vietnam.
Yeah. I feel like that just shows the importance of you also working on the supplier side. I can imagine, you know, working for a retailer and you're coming to me telling me that a farm in, you know, somewhere in Southeast Asia needs to change their practices. I can imagine that being like fairly challenging. It's not as if it's just a farm like around the corner and you can instruct and train them how to provide higher welfare. So the fact that you're also then on that supply side and saying, we probably know, you know, the general region in which your farmers are operating, and we can help specifically in those regions, I imagine they find like incredibly helpful and saves a lot of time going back and forth. If you can also provide that on the supply side.
Yeah, we do think so. And in reality, frequently retailers, because they have high standards of sustainability, for example, they do need to have certain control of who is or not in their supply chain. So the good thing is that they're not completely powerless. Actually, the contrary, they have quite a bit of power through their purchasing. Yeah, so through their voting with their wallet, let's say.
Yeah.
So that facilitates these introductions. Really facilitate us finding a more fertile ground to have discussions to improve things that, you know, that their buyer wants to see. Mm. It's different when you talk to, like in some countries, they are purchasing from a very nuclearized supply chain. And there it is very difficult to go down the kind of demand side down to the producer. They're very dispersed. So sometimes, let's say in the US, retailers in the US frequently buy from India, for example. And in India, the way that the industry is structured is you have a lot of small producers who then all sell into a large processor who is kind of aggregating a lot of shrimps, who then export to the US. There, it is much more difficult to actually implement change at the farm level through that kind of route, top-down route. So we also work with small producers and trying to figure out ways in which we can support them to improve the welfare of shrimps. Because if we, you know, if we leave that production aside, that is about half of the global volume we would be kind of unable to influence. So we also need to find ways in which we work with a small producer in making, you know, marginal progressive improvements to the welfare of shrimps.
Yeah.
And then before you mentioned that you're at least kind of surprised that the supermarkets did actually have some incentive or like some desire to improve the welfare within their supply chains. And do you know what the reason for that is? Because I think it's fair to say there isn't these large campaigns around shrimp welfare going on in the public. So what do you think is driving their kind of desire to improve shrimp welfare?
Yeah. So I would say there's maybe three drivers. The first one, and kind of the more cynic one, could probably be just risk management, like a reputational risk management, so that when those campaigns do come about, so that they can show that they've been proactively trying to manage the situation. Secondly, I would say there are individuals within these large retailers or international buyers who genuinely care about these issues and who individually or like personally do want to see change happen, but sometimes they need support from outside, so us. And then in the specific case of the UK, the work that some organizations have done has really laid the ground for us to come in. So what Crustacean Compassion did in incorporating decapods as part of the animal welfare sentience bill that was passed early last year, yeah, really raised awareness in the general public, but also within those corporates that the issue of decapods, of which shrimps are, by the way, part of the decapod welfare, is an important topic, and that the animal movement is starting to, you know, pay a lot of attention to this. So I think work like that has also helped us quite a bit.
Yeah, great. And you were talking about increasing the salience of the issue as well, and talking specifically about speaking at conferences and, you know, educating the industry. I'm interested that you have gone down the welfare angle and you're looking to improve welfare on the farms, but maybe less so on the outreach to stop consumption. How did you decide on that route over the other? Was it mainly just the Charity Entrepreneurship Report, or was there other elements at play there?
So in our opinion, there were several factors. I think the first one was an organization advocating to stop consumption. To me, it makes more sense to be done by an organization that is doing this kind of, let's say, vegan outreach on a larger scale than on an individual species.
Right.
So like in my mind, it makes much more sense. That message makes much more sense if someone says you should move to a plant-based diet rather than saying you should stop eating shrimp.
Specifically, yeah.
Exactly. And because of the problem, the scale of the problem that we were just talking about is so big, we still thought that it made sense for someone to focus narrowly on shrimp. And that kind of really led to potentially not going down the route of just saying, you know, people should stop eating shrimp, but rather we need to figure out how to improve the lives of these animals in the system that, you know, will probably be here for quite some time. I mean, as a kind of data point, I always try and remind myself that there's 60 million, I think the latest FAO numbers estimate that somewhere around 60 million people work in fisheries and aquaculture.
Wow.
So that to me just talks about the inertia that this industry has. So it'll probably here for decades. So someone really needs to also work on improving the situation today. And I'm very happy that, you know, other organizations will probably take on the angle of we should move on to a plant-based diet. It's better for your health, the environment, animals, etc.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it feels like, I remember even when most advocacy groups started moving towards fish welfare, that felt like a huge step from a public perspective. It felt like at that time, you know, is the public ready to start talking about fish? You know, if we can't get them to care about the more kind of cutesy land animals, little chicks and pigs, you know, how are we going to get them to respond well to talking about fish that aren't our typical, kind of cutesy, attractive animals? And so I imagine shrimp is even, you know, perhaps the next step back, unfortunately. So I think that seems to make a lot of sense. And there are so many orgs working now on fish and hopefully expanding. Do you know of any groups currently that have done anything on shrimp or talk about shrimp at all in terms of consumption?
Yes, there has been work done in Japan. I know that there's been work in Chile, crustacean compassion. Works on crustaceans as a whole, but you know, shrimps are part of it. And there is another organization, I believe, in Philippines, Tambuyog Development Center, I believe they're called, who I've also looked at shrimp. And as you said, with fish, that leap that was taken, and shrimp being slightly quirkier as a kind of as a species to relate to. Joey Savoy from Charity Entrepreneurship. I don't know if this is his authorship, but he did say one day when we were my co-founder and I were about to launch a shrimp welfare project, he said, "Beware that fish is already kind of on the outer edge of people's circle of moral compassion, and you guys will be working with shrimp, who are essentially the fish of fish." which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and speaking of it, also I think Fish Welfare Initiative have done a little bit of work on shrimp. I think, if I can tell, accidentally in there they said they ended up working with some farmers who also farmed shrimp as well as fish, and then improving their lives, which is a nice little bonus.
You're right. And I would say, to their credit, it's not accidentally, it was like incidentally, maybe.
Yes.
And for quite some time, I think they had improved the lives of significantly more shrimps than we had for, you know, for the first maybe 12 months of the existence of Shrimp Welfare Project. And they do fantastic work with fish and have also improved the lives of, I believe it was somewhere around 1 million shrimp.
I remember a million as well.
Yeah.
Cool. And then, so maybe moving more on to shrimp as animals, as well as the state of current shrimp farming. Can you just give us a quick overcap of, I guess the question that I think you've been asked, probably much to your annoyance, is, can shrimp even suffer? Do shrimps feel pain? And I bet you just roll your eyes every time you hear this. But not everyone has heard the answers. So, I mean, if you're willing to oblige us, give the overview of the evidence behind that.
Absolutely. So thankfully, there's this paper that was put out as part of Crustacean Compassion's work in the UK to have decapods included in the animal, in the sentience bill of 2022. The government commissioned a review of the evidence of sentience of both cephalopods and decapods to Jonathan Birch at the London School of Economics. And this is might get technical, but what they did is, because there's no smoking gun to prove sentience, there's nothing that you can just say, this animal is sentient. They look at several different aspects of the knowledge that we have on decapods and cephalopods, and they basically look at eight. They look at possession of nociceptors, so whether they have the right body parts to feel pain, whether they have integrative brain regions to process those stimuli that they receive in the nociceptors, whether there's connections between those two, whether we see adaptive responses to applying analgesics or anesthetics. So to mainly to figure out whether something is a reflex or not, you put an anesthetic on a, you know, on a body part of an animal and kind of apply an abrasive, like action and check whether they respond differently or not, etc. So they define eight, and then they check whether there's evidence in the literature whether these animals fulfill those different criteria. And what they found is that shrimps fulfill a number of these criteria to more or less degree. But they also then compare it to other or combine it with other decapod, the knowledge that we have on other decapods. And basically, out of those eight, there is good evidence that decapods, you know, have high to very high confidence that they have six out of these eight different criteria. And that is essentially as much as we have for cephalopods as well, which, you know, everybody assumes, oh yeah, of course, octopuses are obviously sentient. But then when you look at the aggregate evidence of decapods, even though they've been studied, shrimps and specifically haven't been studied as widely for these types of things, the evidence is pretty significant. And the recommendation that they gave was that they should all be included and regarded as sentient. And they eventually were included as sentient in the bill. But this is, it's important to mention that the UK is not the only country that has recognized the sentience of shrimps. Austria, Switzerland, Norway, and even the European Food and Safety Authority as far back as 2005 had already recommended that decapods were included as sentient because the scientific evidence indicated that they could experience pain and distress. So, you know, the evidence is really there.
I mean, governments are known of being pretty conservative, I would say. And so if they're likely to say something, that's usually a good sign that the evidence is like fairly concrete or like good enough. And same as academia is also fairly conservative. So I think that's a pretty good sign that there must be a good body of evidence behind the case. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
I agree.
Can you just define for us the difference between decapods and cephalopods and which animals fall into both of the categories?
Oh yeah, sorry. Cephalopods are more like octopuses and cuttlefish and squid. And decapods are crabs, shrimps, crayfish,
right?
Lobsters. Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
Then maybe to move on to... okay, so we're sold. Shrimps can feel pain. Everyone knows it. Like, okay, that's finished. The next thing is actually shrimp farming. So, I mean, I know literally nothing, I think, about shrimp farming, more or less. Do you want to give us like the details of from the life of a shrimp from day zero when they're born to the day they're slaughtered? Like, how does that process look and the stages involved?
Yeah, it's way more complicated than we expected it to be when my co-founder and I started working on it. And for anyone who's sufficiently curious to look at the like a diagram of how this happens, there is a report that we published in our India scoping report on our website that talks about the Indian industry, but also has some good diagrams of the different stages, the life stages of a shrimp in a farming system. But to simplify it, there's the broodstock, which is kind of the shrimp that is used to lay eggs. These are typically raised under very extremely biosecure conditions, frequently in Hawaii and Texas. Those are very big hubs to produce these kind of mother shrimps. The reason why
it's so biosecure? Oh, yeah, sorry, you're going to say.
No, that's a good question.
Very weird.
We really kind of kept thinking about this. It's because there's diseases are the biggest source of losses in shrimp farming industry, and these losses are in the billions of dollars every year. And so you can have diseases either from contamination in the environment if you have a pond where you have shrimps, or you can have them because the parent actually had some disease and the babies are already born with diseases. So what they do in these places is they create what are called SPF and SPR broodstock, which technically they mean specific pathogen free. So that kind of guarantees when people buy an SPF broodstock shrimp, they know that it's free of pathogens. So then they take it to wherever it's going to be reproduced, in India, in Vietnam, in Thailand, and then they're used to reproduce. Or they are an SPR, and they know that they will be resistant to certain diseases. And there's typically a trade-off between the speed at which shrimps are grown and then their vulnerability to diseases. But anyway, broodstock are produced in Hawaii and Vietnam frequently, then shipped, let's say, to India, where they're put in a broodstock maturation center, which is a place where they produce the baby shrimp. These broodstock are here they're subjected to eye-stalk ablation, which is a practice that I'm sure we'll talk about. But they start producing eggs like crazy. These eggs hatch. Then these baby shrimps are kept in a hatchery for about 12 days. Then they are all scooped out of that little tank and put in a larger tank, which is a nursery, for another about month. And then again, they're scooped out of that one and moved on to a grow-out pond for another anywhere between 2 to 4 months. So it's really, what is it, between, 3.5 and 5.5, 6 months total life in a farming system.
And I can imagine, just because of the quantity of moving that many individuals, as you've said before, there's just, like, I would imagine, zero consideration for welfare at this point. It's this kind of the same as fish, when they're being like transferred from one, like a growing pond, to a one where they're expected to mature more. It's just kind of a production line, as you would see with any other product that wasn't sentient. It's just like moving this item from one area to the next.
Like, completely. The only thing that I would say, which has, a good and a bad element to it, is that shrimps are very, I'm not sure whether the word is fragile, but they're delicate animals at this life stage. So they do tend to try to not kill them, which is, the bare minimum that you would expect. But but the reality is that the mortality is still, at kind of up to nursery level, is probably around 50%. So it's huge.
Wow.
They try to keep, the water quality, they maintain it to the highest degree possible. These are the parts of the production system where the water quality can be maintained to a much greater degree, because tanks tend to be smaller.
Right.
And they do kind of really fine tune, so to speak, the water quality, but still the mortalities are huge.
Mm. Is that for disease, or what are the reasons for dying such a high rate?
I think disease, there's always, in places where shrimp farming is performed, there's always pathogens present in the water. The bodies of the bodies of water and the rivers and canals have all been really contaminated. They're also just very fragile. And I think naturally they're species that where a lot of the babies would die even in nature. And then there's a lot of handling, as Amy was saying.
It's always astounded me, the numbers that we just seemingly, or the industry seemingly, accept in transit. I always found that, even with fish, that, or perhaps even chickens, there's like these percentages of mortality in transit from like one area to another that we don't even think about, right? We talk about numbers for consumption, we talk about and then when we bring that to animal lives and actually realize that so many of them aren't even making it to the consumer, they've died like in the production line at some point, they've not even gone through a slaughter process, they've died in transit, or they've died, because of excess handling. I feel like these numbers are always just completely astounding. So then I guess also the industry is bearing that in mind and producing, you know, 50% more than they need, because we're going to lose 50%. That, you know, so in these trillions and trillions, these so many more individuals are coming in because we're just going to have such a loss of life during the process. It's astounding.
Absolutely. And that's one of the big areas of uncertainty in these estimates that we were talking about earlier of how many shrimps are farmed or killed or die every year for human consumption. It's because the levels of mortality at early stages of their life stage, or in some systems that are extensive where mortality is almost 95%, that the number is like go completely berserk. In the variability that you can assume.
And in terms of the actual farms, I know like in places like India, the fish are also farmed inland, but with shrimp, is it all exclusively in, you said, like rivers or in the sea, or there's some also like inland, like mud related tanks?
They're in tanks typically. When I said that they contaminate the rivers, is because it's the water from the rivers and the canal that then are brought into these ponds that are inland. I think in that same report, the India scoping report that we did, there are a lot of images, and then in the in our Vietnam scoping report as well. But basically, there are these either kind of holes dug in the ground about 2 meters deep. And then depending on the country, they're either 1 acre or 20 hectare big, and they're filled with water, and that's where the shrimps are produced. Sometimes they have like a plastic lining, sometimes frequently, depending on the country, they might not. And in some cases, there are these tiny tanks which might be maybe 10 meters in diameter, round tanks where they're all plastic lined, and where the stocking densities are just through the roof. So depending on the system, stocking densities are a problem.
We'll definitely link to that report because that seems very useful.
Yeah, I think so. We're very proud of that report.
Nice. Okay, we'll definitely link it.
And in terms of the welfare issues then, so we've talked about poor water quality. We see that with fish as well. I think that's a really important one. Stocking density, obviously, if we're just packing a load in, it's not useful for the animals. Inhumane slaughter, you know, not using any sort of stunning. But I think the one that's I didn't know about, certainly before you began your work and I started to learn more about shrimp, is eye stalk ablation. Can you talk us through that process?
Yeah, this is a very this is a mutilation. Crustaceans are frequently subjected to mutilations. In the case of shrimps, the broodstock that we were talking about at the beginning of this kind of description of the life stages, in the 70s, scientists realized that if there is a gland in the eyes of the females that secretes a hormone that basically sends the message to the body of the female saying, this is not an appropriate environment to reproduce, and it kind of withholds the laying eggs. So by cutting off the eye, it overpowers this natural drive not to reproduce, and it's the female starts laying egg and goes into like an overdrive, so much so that, you know, there's the suffering of the mutilation itself, but then because their bodies go into this kind of overdrive of laying eggs in a much quicker rate than they otherwise would, these females die much quicker, either from the injuries sustained at the moment of the mutilation, or because their bodies are just depleted much faster than they would be if they are not subjected to this practice. Thankfully, there's a group of scientists. The lead researcher's name was Simão Zacarias, who proved from the University of Stirling, who proved that if the females are taken care of properly, they do not need to be subjected to this practice to be as productive. So you can have a female that lays just as many eggs throughout their lives, if they are kind of fed the right things and they are kept in tanks in the conditions that are more, you know, that are better or perceived as better by the animal, which is, you know, fantastic, and which means that is something that, you know, we can demand, saying you should be able to produce your baby shrimps without mutilating the female in this way. But also, even more importantly, which is something that we really highlight as much as we can anywhere we go to, what he found was that the babies of these females who were not mutilated are actually more robust, which is kind of, it makes sense, right? They're born to a mother that is less stressed and has, you know, better health conditions, and those baby shrimps end up being more resistant to, for example, sudden salinity variations, which is something that is kind of happens in a farming system and is bad for shrimps and can kill some shrimps. So these baby shrimps would be more resistant to that, but also to pathogens, as we talked about earlier. Some of these pathogens that are always present in the water might not end up manifesting themselves as diseases in these shrimps, which to the industry, this should be, you know, this should be
top priority.
All running towards. Yeah, exactly. Which, to their credit, in a significant part of the world, they've done it. Namely in Latin America, that this practice is being phased out. And then in Asia, much less so. But this is something that the industry kind of is working on. And the buyers in Europe, primarily in the UK, but also in other places in Europe, are pushing their suppliers to only source baby shrimps from nurseries or from hatcheries that did not use this practice. Much more work needs to be done, but this one is kind of moving in the right direction.
Just so, I think, like, graphic, the sense of like cutting off that part of the body. Obviously we know, even in, you know, with hens, they're like producing eggs, they're bred to produce eggs at such a faster rate, and so they're dying earlier as well. I think often when it's different, there's like different welfare asks. I feel like as a regular member of the public, it's kind of like they don't see all of the things that go into the supply chain, the mutilations, you know, pigtail docking, things like this. It's just like, oh yeah, the animal maybe had a slightly sad life, then they were killed, and then, you know, for my consumption. And I think when you actually go into the depth of it and see all these different areas that the industry or the different ways in which the industry are inflicting pain on the animals, even within the supply chain before slaughter, it's always just astounding to me.
I agree. And slaughter in the case of shrimps, which is, as I mentioned at the beginning when James asked the question of what else I had changed my opinion on, we initially thought, well, you know, slaughter must be really bad, but there's all these other things that we need to work on, like poor water quality and eye stalk ablation, etc. But when we witnessed a quote-unquote harvest in India, and we saw how the shrimps were being pulled out of the water and then just put on crates to be drained out of the water and piled on top of each other, and you know, it was such a horrible sight that we decided we needed to look into it much more.
And is that what they're classing as the slaughter, is just asphyxiation?
So typically the industry would claim that they're doing immersion in ice water slurry, so in just watery ice, which we frequently have seen that that's not the case. But even if it were, there is some evidence now or some concern that this is really just might be even prolonging the suffering of the shrimps, because it might even just reduce the metabolic rate, which then might immobilize them, but not necessarily render them unconscious and potentially prolong their lives. So them taking longer to die than they would have if they had only asphyxiated. I had the unfortunate event of seeing a shrimp that had been out of the water in a like in a cold room 6 hours after it had been taken out of the water, and it was still moving. And I asked the person in the processing plant, "Is this a reflex, or the shrimp is actually alive?" He said, "No, he's it's alive. They sometimes come in and they last for a long time, but it's okay because that means it will be delicious." Is what it's like. Oh,
no.
So we did eventually started taking slaughter much more to the heart of our work, and that's now a significant portion of what we try and improve.
And what is the slaughter that you recommend?
So there is growing evidence that as with many species, shrimps can be rendered unconscious through an electric shock, and then while unconscious being immersed in ice, which then would kill them while unconscious.
Right.
So in the same way that land farmed animals would be stunned pre-slaughter, they're stunning for shrimps exist, and it's as with many crustaceans, what looks like most promising is electrocution.
Mm. And actually, something I didn't ask about before, but I do want to go back, is how long do shrimps usually live? Because you said they usually are killed after six months in the supply chain, but what's their normal lifespan?
It depends on the species, but I would say somewhere around 2 years. But they could last longer depending on the species, but I would say roughly 2 years.
So something you're trying to do now is you're trying to work with producers to basically get them to purchase or get them to use this stunning equipment, because I think you said before this does exist, right? This equipment to actually stun fish before slaughter.
Yeah, so that's a very good question. That's a very important part of our work. So the equipment exists. It has existed for quite some time. The first producer started using it in maybe 3 years ago. They received an award from Compassion in World Farming. This was a joint effort with Tesco and Hilton Seafoods, who are a buyer in the UK. But then we never saw any other producer to start using the technology since. And then we realized through conversations with retailers that retailers actually want their producers to start stunning their shrimps. It's just that they were facing this resistance from producers who were claiming, it's very difficult to do it in my specific context. It doesn't work in my ponds. It's I don't have electricity. So there were all these excuses that are being given by producers, and those had been kind of blocking the adoption of this technology. And one of the important things that we've been working on is we've been piloting unlocking the adoption of this technology and getting producers to start using it in different contexts. There, we have now signed agreements with two producers in Central America to start stunning their shrimps pre-slaughter. And we have we're having advanced conversations with a number of others, which if everything goes well, that would potentially mean that somewhere in the order of a billion with a B shrimps will start suffering less at the moment of slaughter in a very short time, which we are extremely, extremely proud of. And that's one of our key programs and one that we are keen to see developed. And
amazing. Okay, that is a lot to unpack. Thank you so much for talking us through the process. I think with it being such a new species that we're focusing on, it's really important to get the facts and sort of details right there. So thanks for answering those questions. I'm interested then in some key learnings. I guess as a new organization, you've incubated through the Charity Entrepreneurship Incubation Program. I'd be keen to know what have been some of your most important learnings so far.
That's a very good question. And I would say from my perspective, it would be that it is important to remain very, very focused on your strategy and your intervention, but it has proven to be really valuable to us as well to keep a small percentage of our time and resources, etc., exploring other ways in which we could improve the welfare of shrimps. And that's basically how we found this idea of improving stunning pre-slaughter. That's how our program coordinator started the Sustainable Shrimp Farmers of India working group, which I think now has I'm gonna say potentially a wrong number, but several dozen farmers. And those have all been kind of small projects that we maintain kind of on an exploratory basis, and then all of a sudden they look like, you know, they have legs to stand on, and then we kind of pursue that a bit. For all of this, I would also say listening to people who have been in the animal movement for us has been extremely, extremely important. A lot of these things really did emerge from having conversations with people like both of you, who have been in this movement for much longer than my co-founder and I have been, or to other people in the animal movement who have kind of created this spark of figuring out new ways to affect change.
You actually mentioned before that there was a couple of points in the Charity Entrepreneurship Report that you disagreed with when you first read it. Do you have like a second to maybe just briefly talk about one of those?
And I think this, just a caveat, like James said, there's only so far you can go with desktop research. And the place that they had gotten to with desktop research was phenomenal. It was just the design of the intervention. It was very, so it was really, we needed to work on dissolved oxygen. And one of the ways that dissolved oxygen can be improved is by increasing aeration. So aeration is just artificial ways of moving the water so that it, you know, it naturally has a bit more dissolved oxygen in it. And not having enough oxygen for shrimps is really bad.
Okay.
And therefore, it, you know, improving the levels of dissolved oxygen would be good. But improving the levels of dissolved oxygen, if you don't do it very carefully or with ways in which you can control the incentives that generates, it's just water with more oxygen in it can carry more animals per square meter. So in a given tank, if you just improve dissolved oxygen and you have no real levers to control what the producer is doing, it just might end up turning into the producer growing more shrimps, which was something that, to the credit of Charity Entrepreneurship, was identified as a risk. It just felt that it was a much bigger risk that potentially it was acknowledged, or we just found other ways to attack the problem without running into that risk.
And do you have any advice for anyone besides that who wants to start a charity in the field of animal advocacy, and like, what helps you and how could others learn from you?
So the cheeky answer will probably be apply to the Charity Entrepreneurship Incubation Program. There's typically one cohort per year that has a lot of animal ideas, animal related ideas. Other than that, I think what we have found very useful is to talk to people who've been this for a very long time, to pick their brains, to remain open, and to start kind of to start something. We really started with a completely different idea. We really thought that we were going to just exclusively work on dissolved oxygen, on improving dissolved oxygen for shrimps. And now there's so many more things that we think we need to be working on. And although that remains important, other things that have been brought to our attention are potentially in the short term more tractable. So if we hadn't started the organization and just started getting our hands dirty, we probably wouldn't have found these things. So just getting up and doing it is a good idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, you can only learn so much from desk research, and as good as Child Entrepreneurship Research is, it doesn't beat being on the ground and meeting shrimp producers and seeing farm exists and being like, okay, wow, this is actually a big thing. So yeah, that's really good, I think, advice.
Absolutely, I agree.
And where have you specifically managed to get traction as the big being specific regions where farmers seem more susceptible to the changes? What kind of big wins have you had to date?
Thanks. So now we're going to toot our own horn.
Cloak yourself. Come on.
Yeah. So it really depends on where we're talking about. So the engagement with corporates has been mostly in the UK, and I think this very largely is on the back of the work that, you know, Crustacean Compassion have done, but also just generally the fact that the animal movement has been working on keeping retailers honest in the UK. And they've put us in touch with their producers, and that has led us mostly to Honduras and Vietnam. So this has been kind of the corporate engagement part of our impact. But then in India, for example, we've also, as I was mentioning, we've managed to get a lot of farmers to be interested in addressing welfare issues as a way to potentially improving the outcomes for themselves. It is said in India that roughly one out of every three quote-unquote crops, which is kind of a full life cycle is how they call it, one out of every three life cycles of shrimps results in a financial loss for the small producer.
Wow.
And the main thing the main driver behind that is diseases. And they've realized that shrimps that are better taken care of have a more robust immune system and potentially leads to lower levels of disease and mortality, etc. So we're getting traction in India in particular in that way. And in Vietnam, we have been very well received by industry media outlets so far. And they're republishing a lot of our content around eye-stock ablation in magazines in Vietnamese for Vietnamese farmers, so that they, you know, learn about these issues. So yeah, those have been some really important wins. And thanks for asking.
Yeah, and obviously also the memorandum of understandings, right, you signed with some of the big producers to be interested in the stunning equipment. That seems like a pretty big win as well.
Yeah, that's through the corporate engagement one. And as we were mentioning earlier, that we have signed now with producers who I think roughly produce somewhere around, yes, half a billion shrimps. And if these other two sign, it will probably be around a billion shrimps, you know, being slaughtered more humanely. That's so far potentially our biggest wins. Yeah. And we do want to grow that program, and we are interested in funding it. So if anyone out there is interested, do reach out to me.
As always, like any good nonprofit CEO, you have to put in a funding pitch at some point.
Of course.
Yeah, slip it in at the end.
Cool. Well, maybe let's move on to some general questions to start rounding up slowly. And another light one is, what's a fun or interesting fact you've learned about shrimp over the past 2 years at Shrimp Welfare Project?
One that I really like is that shrimps have their hearts in their head. I thought that was really interesting.
Oh.
There's definitely some deep metaphor in there.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it like that. And by the way, it's funny that you ask. There is on our LinkedIn page, we do publish the shrimp fact of the week every week. They tend to be really, really interesting, at least
nice.
To me.
One thing from me, and actually for us, James, I'm not sure who pointed it out to you initially, but for me, it was about the curling of the shrimp that we have on our logo. I didn't know that this sort of like curls, typical like shrimp figure that we see is actually when they're cooked. And yeah, they're just quite straight when they're just going about their everyday lives. I feel like that was interesting for me. You can't really find like pictures of shrimp that aren't the curly shape. That's also interesting that we're just already talking about them as food before they've even lived their little life.
It's funny that you would mention it, but we were hours away from putting our website live with a curled shrimp on our logo before someone, a very kind person, reached out to us and said, "What are you doing?" So I feel for you, Amy.
We all know now.
yeah, we do know. Hopefully now everyone knows. And they're also not particularly pink, right? They're also kind of like this translucent blue color. Is that right?
Mm. Yeah, there's some that are bluish. There's some that are more like brownish green. And there's another fun fact. There are thousands there. I hope I'm not making up the number, but I think if there's somewhere like 2,000 species of shrimp. The fine ones are really overwhelmingly two or three. But there's it's a very biodiverse group. Wow. And some are super cool. You need to go to our shrimp fact of the week.
Yeah.
We'll definitely link the LinkedIn page with all the shrimp facts.
Yeah, for sure. What's a view that you hold that most animal advocates might disagree with?
All right. So I hope I don't upset too many people, but I do think that the effective altruism movement has had, or the effective altruism funding into the animal movement has had on the movement of swinging in the direction of effectiveness is not all bad. I think there is a tendency lately to say, oh, it's terrible, we've gone too far. And although there may be some truth to that, I think that that's a correct diagnosis, but the result should not be, let's go back to doing, to not measure things. Rather, we need to figure out how to measure complex things better. And I think Social Change Lab were doing some of these things. So potentially some funders had have shied away from funding the building of social movements. And the reason why they might have done that for some time is not because we should stop doing that. It's just someone needed to measure it and figure out whether that's really impactful or not. And it's really complex. And I learned I listened to your previous episode with Faunalytics, and I think you all talked about a very important topic of how do you measure meta organizations, which I think is a very fair point, but it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be measured. It's just we need to get much better at measuring complicated things. And I think that might be something that people will disagree with me on.
Mm. Well, I agree. I think it's great.
Going on to some closing questions then. Any piece of news that you're grateful for or excited about recently?
Well, I do spend quite a bit of time in Spain, so I read more news in Spain. And recently, pets were granted a much higher level of consideration in legislation in Spain, and penalties for people harming their pets were increased very, very significantly. And I think this comes on the back of the good work of many organizations, including, Equalia and I'm sure many others there who've been doing great work in Spain for quite some time.
Nice.
Very cool. How about 2 to 3 media recommendations for listeners, something that you've read or listened to that you think is worth sharing?
This podcast, I mentioned this before we started recording, but I've listened to every single episode so far.
Our biggest fan.
I am partial because of your title, but then in addition to this, The Secret Life of Groceries, I know it sounds really boring, but I found it really interesting to learn this whole, those of us who are working in trying to improve food systems it's really good to understand how complex the system is, and to figure out how, you know, there's other people out there who might want to see this system changed. And I thought that was really good. And then non-animal related, I really enjoyed reading The Moment of Lift by Melinda French Gates. It was really, really, when I was thinking of what to do with my kind of new life, having left finance, just reading something like this, where there were some really obvious things that people needed to be working on and that could improve the lives of, you know, in this case, many, many, many humans. Mm. It just really made me feel very heartwarming to see that things could be improved and should be improved.
Love it. Thank you. We'll put all of the links to those recommendations in the show notes.
Oh, and if anyone does want to read more about shrimps, we have on our webpage in the media section, the Shrimp Welfare Report, and it's just a compilation, like secondary research of a compilation of everything related to shrimp welfare that we found very relevant. I do recommend that as well.
Yeah,
thank you.
Definitely link that.
And other than reading up on shrimp and this important topic, how can people get more involved in your work? Are you hiring at the moment? Do you work with volunteers? What can people provide for you?
Yes and yes. So we are hiring for a head of programs. I don't know exactly the date in which this will air, but we very likely will still be looking for a fantastic head of program. So please do, when in doubt, apply. We have worked with volunteers, and I believe there is a link on our webpage to apply as a volunteer. And I hope we can put a link there on the show notes. And finally, if you feel like James said, the fundraising hat, if you do want to donate, we do think that we are a very good candidate to donate to make the most out of your philanthropic donations to improve the lives of shrimps. Feel free to reach out to me as well if you have any specific ideas on how you think you might be well suited to support us, or if there's a way that I can support you in any of the topics that we've talked about, like launching a new organization or working with invertebrates or working as a parent, etc.
There's
a lot of things that I'd like to talk about.
Very cool.
Amazing.
Nice. Well, that was a landmark episode, our 10th episode with the one and only Shrimp Welfare Project. Thank you so much, Andres, for coming on. It's been such a pleasure to chat.
Yeah, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. The pleasure's been really all mine.